Aloha, you're listening to KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea. It's Malama Kauai, show about sustainability. Starting a little bit late just because we had to finish up that Democracy Now. There's no way we could cut off Noam Chomsky. We'll be getting to it in just a moment.
Everyday people like you and me just want to live naturally. Time taught you and you told me nothing gonna get us down. Can't you see? I said, if it don't matter to you, it don't matter to me. No, 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 no. If it don't matter to you, it don't matter to me. People all around making sounds and all kinds of noise. If I could only get there, then I could enjoy. Let's change the mood right now. Turn down the lights. It's time to cool it down. If it don't matter to you, it don't matter to me. If it don't matter to you, it don't matter to me. Yesterday and what we could be, it don't.
Yeah, we're doing it here Friday. Mahalo for checking it out, KKCR.
Singing on down for me.
The views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of KKCR, its management, board, volunteers, or underwriters.
How do we get to line 3?
Hey. Want to let you know the presentation of Malama Kauai is made possible by listeners like you. In partnership with Qingyang Shopping Village.
Qingyang Shopping Village proudly supports Kauai's community radio by underwriting this program. Qingyang, the heart of Hanalei. Mahalo, Jeff Culverhouse, for your support.
As well as Edible Hawaiian Islands Magazine. And we appreciate all of those underwriters helping us out here on our program, Malama Kauai. My name is Keone Kealoha. I'm joined in studio with
Andrea.
Miss Andrea Brower. And on our program today, our guest is the professor, John Van Dyke. He's a law professor from the University of Hawaii, and that's in Manoa. He's also the author of many books and articles, including Who Owns the Crown Lands of Hawaii? Professor Van Dyke has been on faculty at UH Manoa since 1976. He's a teacher of constitutional law and international law and has a BA from Yale University and a JD cum laude from Harvard University. Quite accomplished.
And Professor Van Dyke is on the phone. We're going to jump right into the show since we're running a little late from Democracy Now!
Aloha, Professor. Are you there?
Yes, aloha. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Definitely. Thank you so much for jumping on. And your book, the... Who Owns the Crown Lands of Hawaii? A very timely subject with the ceded lands issue before the Supreme Court of the United States, and lots of things happening in and around Hawaii on that issue right now. So we thank you very much for taking the time out of your schedule to share with the listeners today some information people probably
yes.
don't know much about.
Well, it's my honor, but and let me also just say that I have been working on that case over the last 14 years mm-hmm. as part of the team representing Office of Hawaiian Affairs. The lead attorney is Sherry Broder, my wife, and Bill Mehiula and Melody McKenzie are part of the team, and we have counsel in Washington as well that we're working with now that the case is before the U.S. Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, your book is a very thick and fascinating historical account of what has kind of happened in Hawaii with land ownership, and well, it wasn't called ownership until very recently, but I think there's so much content to get into here. Do you want to just start by maybe giving an overview of the history of Crown lands in Hawaii?
Yes, I'd be happy to. The Crown lands were the lands that Kamehameha III kept for himself at the time of the Mahele. The Mahele was the division that took place in the late 1840s. It took place under pressure from Western settlers, and also because of the geopolitical activities going on in the Pacific. European powers were seizing Pacific islands as best they could around the Pacific, and Hawaii was seized briefly by the a British naval person in 1843, and the king was concerned that there would be continued efforts to take over Hawaii, and had this idea that if the lands were in private hands, even if the sovereignty of the kingdom was lost, that the native people could keep control of the lands. So the idea was move the lands into private hands and thus try to hang on to the lands for native Hawaiians during this very difficult period. So he allocated one-third of the lands to the high chiefs and put one-third in the hands of the government, and the final third in his own hands, with the idea that the common people, the Makahainana, would be able to make claims against all these lands in the coming years. That didn't really work out for the common people, and they wound up with less than 1% of the land, even though the idea was that they would get one-third or one-fourth in the division. In any event, the king kept about one-third of the lands for himself and managed them as his own lands, but as time went on, the legislature passed a law saying that these lands could no longer be bought and sold and should be kept for future monarchs, and so the name of the lands changed from the king's lands to the crown lands, and they were managed by a commission on the crown lands during the late 1800s. Then, when we get to the overthrow in 1893 and annexation in 1898, the crown lands are mushed together, glommed together with the government lands by the white settlers who overthrew the kingdom, and by the United States when it annexed the territory in 1898. And we then start calling these lands ceded lands because they were ceded by the Republic of Hawaii to the United States in 1898. But I find it useful to separate them back out because these lands were uniquely Hawaiian lands. The monarchs, of course, could only be Hawaiian, and the monarchs held those lands very much in trust for the Hawaiian people. And Prince Kohio explained that to the U.S. Congress in the years leading to the Hawaiian Homes Commission Act, and Congress accepted that the crown lands were to be held in trust for the native people and did return some of the lands in the Hawaiian Homelands Program. But even though the idea of the program was a good one, the implementation was awkward because only the marginal lands were included in the Hawaiian Homelands Program, and the good lands were set apart for sugar. But we at least get the principle that these lands were trust lands for the Hawaiian people, and that's the sort of unfinished business, that the Hawaiian people still have a claim against these lands. That's clearly recognized in Hawaii's constitution. It's clearly recognized in the apology resolution that the Congress passed in 1993. It's been recognized by Governor Lingle, by Governor Cayetano, and so on. And So we need to address and resolve this issue. And so the case that is now before the U.S. Supreme Court was decided a year ago by the Hawaii Supreme Court. And the Hawaii Supreme Court simply said that these lands, the ceded lands, must be kept intact. They can't be bought and sold or transferred until the claims of the Hawaiian people are resolved. So it was an excellent decision, a proper decision to protect the trust lands. But the governor saw fit to appeal that to the U.S. Supreme Court, and a hearing's now scheduled for February 25th on that matter in Washington.
Well, that was a great overview. I think one of the things that you just kind of left off with there is these lands were ceded by the Republic to the U.S. government, but the Republic had illegally overthrown the Hawaiian monarchy, so there was no consent or compensation on part of the Hawaiians.
That's right. In the apology resolution, the Congress specifically says that the overthrow was illegal, was a violation of international law, and that the transfer, that the lands were taken from Native Hawaiian people without their consent or without any compensation to them. So the factual record is clear on that, and so we have the basis for a claim, and that needs to be addressed and resolved. Now, this type of claim, which is based on things happening more than 100 years ago, are not really appropriate for the courts to sort out. So we expect the political branches, the legislature and the governor, to get involved in these negotiations. But the court, the Hawaii Supreme Court, quite properly protected the lands and made sure that they aren't lost in the process while this reconciliation effort is going forward. So that's the case, and it's a simple and straightforward case, and it was surprising to most of us that the state took the appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, and that the U.S. Supreme Court granted certiorari and set it for hearing. So it's a peculiar situation, but it's our hope that the U.S. Supreme Court, once they take a closer look at it, will realize that this is not a matter for the federal courts to deal with, and the state courts should be able to retain jurisdiction over this problem.
You know, one thing that I wanted to put out there too, in reading through your through the book, is that in every time there was some elevation of ownership by the United States, that there was a resolution or an act that recognized that the lands were to be held in trust, like. Back in the 1898 time, there was a Newlands Resolution, and then in 1900, the Organic Act. In some ways, those from the legislature, you know, did specifically state those things. And then the Native, the Hawaiian Homelands Act program, and then also even in the 1959 Admissions Act, and then, as you mentioned, more specifically, more clearly, and more recently, the Apology Resolution. So it wasn't as if, you know, it was ever in question. There was always, once they moved forward with annexing or creating some kind of higher level of, you know, management, they always kept going back and recognizing officially that these lands are supposed to be held in trust.
Oh, absolutely, and you've summarized that sequence very well. In addition, in 1899, the U.S. Attorney General issued an opinion saying that these lands are to be held in trust. The lands were never combined with the public lands of the United States. And were always kept apart because of the recognition that that these lands have a special trust status. And in the Admission Act, the Congress says that the revenues from these lands are to be used for five specific purposes, one of which was for the betterment of the conditions of Native Hawaiians. And so the state then accepted that responsibility. And in the 1978 Constitutional Convention, put forward some amendments, one of which says specifically that there are two beneficiaries of the ceded lands. One is the general public, and the other is the Native Hawaiian people. So they're clearly a beneficiary, and they have claims that need to be addressed and resolved.
Yeah, so, you know, a lot of people, when they first hear about this reconciliation or things, they think, oh, it happened so long ago, this has always been part of the United States. But I think what people don't realize is there's a very consistent trail of recognition that these lands were to be held in trust for the Hawaiian people all the way up until the present day. I think people find it hard to say, well, in trust for the Hawaiian people, who is that? What does that mean? Who is going to come in and manage it? Or who do these lands get turned back over to manage? And that's kind of a question that, you know, I think a lot of the sovereignty groups are pushing forward and saying, how do you come together and create that official body that could then step forward or assume the role of the reinstated kingdom or a national Hawaiian sovereign entity?
And that also, if you look at the intent and the original purpose of these lands, they weren't, I mean, the crown lands, yes, the king did, or the elite did sell some or lease a small part, but they were mostly so that he could uphold, or he or she could uphold, their duty as a mo'i, so their duty to their people to grant access to them so that they could live with the aina.
Well, absolutely. And the question of how to go forward is a complex one. It's sort of a chicken and the egg situation. Mm-hmm. Do you first reorganize the Native Hawaiian government, or do you return land first? And most people feel that you need a legitimate body that represents the Native Hawaiian people before you can engage in serious negotiations. So there are various ways that such a reorganized government could be reestablished, but one certainly would be the Akaka Bill, which lays out a procedure whereby the Native Hawaiians would be listed on a roll, and then they would participate in a process whereby they would come together and reconstitute their government. And then, once the government is reconstituted, negotiations begin for the return of land and resources. And we have a model from Aotearoa, New Zealand, where this has been done with the Maoris. The people of New Zealand passed a statute called the Waitangi Tribunal Act, which created a tribunal that has heard the claims of the various Maori iwi, the Maori tribes, and then has made a recommendation, which has led to negotiations and return of very substantial amounts of land, and also factories and fishing rights and ships and processing factories. And so this has been something that we can look to for guidance, because the Maoris are now very much back on their feet and have substantial resources. And when economic decisions are made in New Zealand now, the Maoris are at the table, whereas here the Hawaiians are still on the outside looking in, and they need to be back in the economic action.
Yeah, it seems like there's the idea of the Akaka Bill holds some skepticism for people, obviously, because they feel that it might legitimize the process, but perhaps to the disadvantage of the Hawaiian people, and, you know, and
kind of confirm the colonial government.
Right. So it's, you know, it's like and even that process is kind of the chicken and the egg too. It's like, we need to do something to organize at a point where we can engage, but is this the right way to carry that process forward? Is there another, you know, more homegrown kind of movement where you have, like, for example, the reinstated Hawaiian government, who has, as far as international law, tried to execute every component of what would be necessary to reinstitute the Hawaiian governmental body to engage in those kind of discussions. And there are other groups too, not to diminish the other groups that are out there as well. But
this is obviously complex. If Hawaii were to become independent, let's assume, as some of the groups advocate, I think you would still need something like an Akaka Bill, because you'd still have the Hawaiians being a minority, and they would still have very strong and special claims to land and resources. So I'm always a little bit surprised about the opposition to the Akaka bill, because it doesn't preclude any ultimate outcome, but it does recognize the special rights and special role of the Native people, and I think it would be something that would be necessary even if Hawaii were to somehow become independent. Mm.
So it could be a bill in an independent nation, though, more. I think you would know more about this than I do, but from what I've always understood, it's that if that bill is drafted by the U.S. colonial power, and it basically makes Hawaiian, it gives Hawaiians the same status as, for example, other Native American tribes have had. So you have a nation within a nation, but a nation that can never truly be sovereign.
Yes, this is complicated, but we do have non-Native people in the islands now, as well as Native people, and all people have rights and human rights. So, given the reality, I think that we have to accept that most of the non-Native people are comfortable with the relationship with the United States. There's not going to be a majority of the people of Hawaii wanting independence anytime soon. So what do? We at least should be protecting the rights of the Native people, because they have a right of self-determination. The people of Hawaii as a whole, seems to me, did exercise self-determination in 1959 in deciding to become a state in the United States, and are now, the people of Hawaii as a whole, are self-governing. We vote for members of Congress and presidents, and actually we have more power than people in other states, because we're small and we have two senators, and one of our senators is the head of the Appropriation Committee, and one is a Native Hawaiian. And by the way, the President of the United States was born and raised in Hawaii, too. So we're doing pretty well in terms of self-governance. But the Native people of Hawaii still have a separate and distinct right of self-determination that needs to be pursued and developed, because they have a right to autonomy under U.S. and international law, and that is something that hasn't been fulfilled. The Native Hawaiians are the only Native people in the United States that have never had a claims commission or a settlement package developed for them at the federal level. And it's always been odd to me, because they're one of the largest groups of Native people that we have in the United States, and yet somehow they've been outside the process that other Natives have pursued to get land and resources. This is long overdue. The Alaska Natives are similar in some respects to Native Hawaiians in being ethnically distinct from North American Natives, but from a legal perspective, they were recognized as having separate and distinct rights, and a statute was passed for them in 1971, whereby millions of acres of land were transferred back to them, and they now, many of them, are doing very well. So the Hawaiians have been sort of left out of this process, and it's long overdue for them to get their recognition and their lands.
Just some details. How many acres of crown lands are there existing still?
It's about a million acres. So Hawaii as a whole is a little bit more than 4 million. So we're talking about almost 25% of the lands. And these are beautiful lands, picked specifically by Kamehameha III. They're scattered all over the state. On Kauai, it's most of the western part of Kauai, including the whole area along the west part of the island, but it also includes what's now Princeville and Anahola and Kapa'a and Wailua, Hanapepe, Kalaheo. So it's probably about two-fifths of Kauai are crown lands. So particularly a lot there. On Oahu, the crown lands are along the Waianae Coast and all of Waimanalo and Waimea Valley, and then key areas scattered in Honolulu and Kailua, Kaneohe.
So a considerable amount, I think, in the book you've mentioned. It's almost 2 million, which makes up the crown, the government, and the public lands.
That's right.
So there's like 1.8 million acres.
Right, 1.8 were transferred to the United States at the time of annexation.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, for some folks that maybe didn't catch it at the beginning, just to say that the crown lands were lands that during the Mahele were apportioned by the Mo'i, or the king of king, which happened to be Kamehameha III at the time. And those lands, as a Mo'i, as the king of the islands, the purpose was not for him to own these for himself, as Andrew had mentioned too. It was to really utilize these lands to the benefit of the common people, to the residents, to the Hawaiians, and to manage it as such. And the reason why all of the division of lands happened, and that this land was taken by the king, was in his sense was to preserve that idea that the Mo'i or the king would always have lands that would be able to take care of the common people. I think the thing that people often say is that, well, the king just took the lands because he wanted his own land, and, you know, the idea of Western land ownership and traditional Hawaiian ali'i or monarchy land responsibility and management differ in that. Nobody owned the lands per se. He didn't own the lands necessarily. He held them in trust to manage them for the benefit of the people.
Well, absolutely, and you see that in the way the ali'i handled the lands when they had no heirs to pass them on to. So Princess Bernice Pauahi, when she died without children, of course, she created this wonderful trust for the Kamehameha schools, mm-hmm. that has been designed and to educate the Native Hawaiian children. And Prince Liliuokalani did the same thing and left her personal lands to the Children's Center, which was designed to deal with orphans and children with special needs. And William Lunalilo also set up a trust for the elderly with his lands. So we have these three examples of these selfless, altruistic acts being done by the Hawaiian ali'i, which make it clear that the Mo'i also saw it that way, mm-hmm. and that the crown lands were not thought of as personal lands in the way Westerners think of ownership, but rather as trust lands to be used for the benefit of the Native Hawaiian people.
Which is a great example, just to say, look at those ali'i and what they did with the lands, and how they did give back to take care of the Hawaiian people, to take care of the people of Hawaii. And can you imagine, had those crown lands remained in that state, what could those be doing for the greater benefit of the people of Hawaii today? So that's really what we're talking about with the crown lands, is how can those lands be utilized to the greater benefit, rather than being held, you know, and not utilized, or not being managed in a way that the resources are benefiting all, has kind of seemed to be the case, you know, as being held in trust to a certain extent by the state. It's almost like tooth and nail to try to be able to utilize the land for many things. It seems to be like something that wants to be put in under lock and key and kept away as a kind of a treasure, rather than a resource to be utilized by all. Yeah. I did want to open up the phone lines. I know Andrew has a question, but we did start a little bit late today because of the broadcast of Democracy Now!, which was running a bit behind. So we'd like to open up the phone lines if people would like to call in and talk with Professor Van Dyke about his new book that came out last year, Who Owns the Crown Lands of Hawaii. We have some comments, suggestions, ideas. Please call in. 826-7771 is the number.
And we already have callers. And Professor, if there's anything else that you want to bring up before you start getting a bunch of questions. I also was really fascinated in, you touched on it briefly, the part of your book that goes into the history of the Great Mahele and what circumstances kind of led King Kamehameha III to decide to institute the Great Mahele, because a lot of people, like Keone mentioned earlier, tend to think, oh, well, they decided to institute the system of private property. But the great irony of it was that he was trying to keep, in doing it, he was trying to keep foreign powers from taking over Hawaii.
Yes, and of course it didn't work out as planned. The lands that went to the Ali'i, in some cases, moved rapidly into Western hands through various maneuvers. And then the crown lands, which he thought should be kept in Hawaiian hands, were just taken over by the white settlers at the time of the overthrow, and then by the United States at annexation. So the result he was trying to avoid did happen, but we in our time, I think, can try to right these wrongs and achieve justice by getting lands back into the hands of the Native Hawaiian people.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have a caller. K.O., are you there?
Yes, here I am.
Hey.
Morning, Doc. Read your book. A lot of resources in there.
Oh, thank you.
And I was wondering if you could explain how American soil is considered in Hawaii, where it is, and how did it become American soil?
There was an annexation, of course. The annexation was very awkward.
It was illegal.
There was a treaty proposed, which the Senate would not ratify, and then they got a simple...
There was no treaty. It was a resolution.
Right. They got a simple majority of both.
There's
the House
no
re- and Senate.
There's no treaty. Can you explain to me legally how that term, American soil, here in Hawaii Nei? Because so far what you said is an illegal process.
Yes, I agree, and that's what the Congress...
and then it goes, reaches up. Hawaiian issues reaches up as the highest office in the world, the United States presidency.
Yeah, I think it's going to be better if you say things and then I say things rather than we try to
speak
over each other.
Yeah, let's try to...
Okay, thank you very much. Aloha.
Yeah. Okay, mahalo.
So, if you look at the constitutional law... texts in the early 1900s, they raise serious questions about how Hawaii was annexed and whether the annexation was consistent with the Constitution. And so those issues are still very much on the table. But then I think what makes it more complicated is that in 1959 there was a vote of the people of Hawaii to become a state of the United States. And the vote was 93%, so 17-1. The Hawaiians were very much involved in that effort. There were lots of Hawaiians playing strong leadership roles in the statehood movement. The Hawaiians wanted statehood because they thought they would be able to participate in their own governance much better, because under the territory, the governor and all the judges were appointed from Washington. And so statehood was seen as sort of a home rule effort. And, of course, it did lead to Hawaiians playing a more substantial role in governance. And we've had John Waihei as governor and Danakaka as our senator and so on. So the Hawaiians play significant roles in the governance of Hawaii at the present time. So the question then becomes, well, does the statehood vote sort of override the illegalities that took place back in 1893 and 1898? Obviously, there's still a lot of things unresolved and on the table, and that's why I've been working with other lawyers to try to find a path to sort all this out and to get lands and autonomy back to the Native Hawaiian people, and that's what we've been trying to do.
So I realize that state vote complicates things, but like the caller was saying, and my question is, the Republic of Hawaii illegally came in with and instigated an armed takeover of the Hawaiian monarchy, and they are the ones who ceded or whatever the lands to the United States, and so that's where the it all trickled out, it all kind of got started. Or I mean, that's where, you know, from then on, it territory annexation, right. Statehood.
No, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But then, two generations later, the people of Hawaii, including the Native Hawaiian people, decided that the best thing for Hawaii was to become a state, and they worked very hard on this. And I lived in Virginia at the time as a youngster, and I can assure people that statehood for Hawaii was not all that popular in the rest of North America, and that it was a very difficult process, but in the end, the decision was made to accept Hawaii as a state. And I think it was good for the United States and good for Hawaii. If Hawaii wanted to become independent, that is something that, you know, could and should be discussed. But the question would be, you know, do the people of Hawaii really want to be independent? And this has come up in Canada. The Canadian Supreme Court has been giving opinions about Quebec, where lots of people in Quebec want to become independent. And what they said is that if there was a substantial majority of the people of Quebec that made it clear that they wanted to be independent, then the rest of Canada would have to talk about that and have to work something out. So that would be the case here, that if a substantial majority of the people of Hawaii wanted independence, and the rest of the country would have a duty to talk about it and to work something out.
So KO did want to come back on and make make another comment there in relation to the information.
Yes, you said that the Native Hawaiians participated in the vote. The governor just made an announcement. Native Hawaiians do not have legal claim to the land. So what good would their vote be? Yeah, they have never spoken for the land. So if you bring up Native Hawaiians, the governor just cut them off. Explain that, please.
Governor Lingle now, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I think the governor's pursuit of this case to the U.S. Supreme Court has been odd and awkward. She has supported Native Hawaiian efforts in other circumstances, and Native Hawaiians have voted for her. But now, when the claim seems to be getting someplace, she takes the other side. So I think it is very awkward, but I remain optimistic that our legislature and our people as a whole are going to support the claims of Native Hawaiians, and that we're going to make progress in this reconciliation process that's now going on.
The Native Hawaiian is a fictitious person. We should stop supporting a fictitious person. It's like saying that I see a blonde, but when I get intimate, I find out she's not a true blonde. And so that is what the Native Hawaiian is. A Native Hawaiian is a false blonde. She's not a true blonde. A Native Hawaiian is not a true Hawaiian. Okay, he got all his powers from the Kanaka Maoli. And that is the name of the race. And that is why a Native Hawaiian cannot claim his assets as an imperfect, fictitious person ID. And thank you very much. Aloha.
Thank you, Kayla. Right.
Aloha. We have another caller online. Makana, you there?
Hi, yeah. I really appreciate the information. It's very informative. John, your work is well done and well appreciated.
Thank you.
I have the thoughts at this moment in terms of what do we do in terms of resolution and looking back at the horrible errors or whatever past. But there was a vote. Don't we ask now, in this new consciousness, what is the current status? And if you look at the evolution of that paradigm, we have military all over our lands. Management of our lands is in total disrepair. Nobody's taking responsibility for it. State, federal or Hawaiian organizations taking real responsibility, the Maka'ainana role in the taking care of the land. So don't we ask now, what does the land want, and what is it going to do for us? You know, and maybe we don't win a vote, a popular vote, but to me it's not about that at this moment. You know, it's just getting real. What does the land want, and how do we get there? So that's a point of view, and just wanted to share.
All right. Well, thank you for that. I appreciate it.
Yes, absolutely. That's a very profound thought. And the Hawaiians, of course, viewed the Aina as part of the Ohana, as something that was alive and needed to be nurtured and malamed, and that if you malama Aina, then it comes back and provides the same nurturing to the humans. So yes, we definitely need to remind ourselves of those values.
You know, he brought up a good point too, and that is, you know, who is malamaing the land, who is taking care of those spaces? And, you know, a lot of cases it's hard because I think when we, you know, our show is about sustainability and our organization focuses on those things. And, you know, without the Aina, it's so hard to be sustainable, to feed yourself, to house yourself, to you know, provide with your basic necessities, or even have a decent quality of life. You know, if you don't have a place to rest your head or to call home or to take care of. And and so, yeah, I mean, what his profound thought was there is really, you know, what one of the main reasons why we wanted to have you on the program in the first place was to say, you know, here is 25% of the lands of Hawaii that were intended initially back when Kamehameha III, you know, divided them and held them in trust, was to do just that, to provide Aina so that people could sustain themselves and could have a good quality of life. So, yeah, it's probably more of a question that we could get to the answer to just today on this program, but that really is the question. How do we utilize our resources in the way that they were intended to be used so that we can move ahead and have a better quality of life?
And that if you don't have a land base, you cannot have a nation. You cannot sustain yourself, and you are forced to participate in some global system that maybe you don't even want to participate in. That, I mean, true autonomy comes from having access to resources and land.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so in the trial of this case, it's now before the U.S. Supreme Court. The trial took place over 5 years ago, but it was filled with expert testimony by Daviana McGregor and Puakana Hele and other practitioners who explained the importance of Aina, of land to Hawaiians, and the fact that we're not just talking about a commodity, something that's bought mm-hmm. and sold, but something that's very much part of the inherent soul of the Kanaka Maoli people, and that if it's lost, if it's dissipated, it can't be just replaced by money.
Yeah, so, you know, where we are right now with the Akaka bill, with the ceded lands case coming up in the Supreme Court, any, you know, and I know, Professor, that you're working with a team of other lawyers to look at some of the legal ways to maybe rectify some of the things that had happened in the past. Is what do you see happening here in the near future? Do you have any predictions or maybe desired outcomes or maybe beneficial outcomes that might be something that we could you know, think about pushing forward?
Yes, thank you. At the federal level, I think it is likely that the Akaka bill will be passed this year and signed into law. So this has been a long, difficult struggle. The congressional delegation drafted the Akaka bill after the Rice versus Cayetano decision in the year 2000, where the Supreme Court indicated that despite all the laws passed by Congress, that there had not been the sort of very formal recognition of Native Hawaiians as Native people that other Native people have had. So the congressional delegation, after long discussions with community leaders and people around the country, drafted the Akaka bill. It's gone through many amendments, and might be amended still further, but it would provide a framework for the Hawaiians to reconstitute their government and would, I think, thereby be a very positive step toward the eventual reconciliation that we're all looking forward. So that's at the federal level. At the state level, there could and I hope will be some legislative action this session to deal with these issues as well. And their bills now being looked at carefully by the leadership in both the House and Senate that might address this whole question of whether the land should be transferred and what circumstances they could or could not be sold. So ultimately, it's a state issue. The state controls its lands. The state legislature makes the laws, and the state legislature can basically instruct the governor as to what should happen. So I'm hoping that there will be some legislation at the state level as well, and we all need to be active in that process, because in a democracy, ultimately, we make the laws. And my experience has been that the non-native community is supportive of the claims of the native people and wants some kind of justice to be reached. And it's similar to the situation in New Zealand, where all the people of New Zealand realized that the Maoris had been mistreated and very much wanted to resolve this in a just and fair way. And I think that's the same thing we're seeing throughout Hawaii, that all the communities realize that the native people have been mistreated and that they deserve justice and equity and land. And that's what we need to work toward.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have been speaking with Professor John Van Dyke from the University of Hawaii Manoa about his book, Who Owns the Crown Lands of Hawaii? Is out in 2008 on the University of Hawaii Press. If you feel so inclined, you could pick up a copy of the book or maybe check your local library. Might have a copy as well. I wanted to thank you for being on the program and sharing your Manao and the information that you had compiled and just being available to speak with some of the callers that were able to express some of their concerns and their thoughts about the matter as well. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Andrea and Keone. I really appreciate being on the show.
Yeah, mahalo.
Definitely. Okay. Aloha.
Bye-bye.
Now, if you are interested in finding out more about that particular book, that publication, you can check the malamakauai.org website. Click on the KKCR link on the homepage, and it will get you to the information. And there are a couple quick announcements. We wanted to thank our callers. There were a couple of people that were on hold, but we are coming to the top of the hour, and Dee's Diner's coming up next. So
yeah, sorry about that, guys. Just a couple quick announcements. Don't miss the third presentation of the Ho'olulu Hawaiian Lecture Series, January 30th and 31st. Rare and special opportunity to learn about hula from the perspective of Kumu Hula Kehaulani Kekua. This presentation is going to be about temples for the dance, sacred traditions of Kauai's Heiau Hula. And Kumu Kehau is a direct descendant of hula kapu masters whose roots are immersed in Ka'ulu Alono and Ka'ulu Apa'oa, two of Kauai's most famous hula temples. And she'll be talking about these he'iau from 6 to 7:30 on Friday, January 30th at Hanalei School Cafeteria. So that's Friday, January 30th, 6 to 7:30, Hanalei School Cafeteria. Admission is free. Donations are welcome. And the following day on Saturday, January 31st, she's going to be giving a workshop from 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. on the basic protocols of the he'iau hula at Limahuli Hale in NTBG Limahuli Garden in Haena. Advanced registration and $35 workshop fee are required, and you can you can visit their website at kaieie.org, kaieie.org.
Yeah, for any more additional information.
Information on that. And also, just to remind people, the Green Map, Malamakua'i Green Map is here. Find it in 50 local businesses around the island, at most rental car and large hotels. And if you want a listing of all of those places, visit malamakua'i.org, your guide to local green businesses, recycling centers, farmers markets, bus stops and a bunch of other really cool stuff. And thank you to Atherton Foundation and Bill Healy Grants for making that possible.
Yeah, mahalo. And there are lots of things happening. There is a community calendar of sustainability-minded issues and community issues that you can find at the SaveKauai.org website if you'd like to check that out. And for any more information on upcoming radio programs, guests of previous programs, you can also check MalamaKauai.org out if you so desire to find out some of those that information about what's going on in the community or what's going on with Malama Kauai.
And just to encourage people to check out that Save Kauai calendar, there are events, about three events every day this month on their beach cleanups and a lot of other things to get involved with. So if you want to jump in, check it out. And see you in 2 weeks. Aloha. Yeah.
Mahalo again to our guest, Professor John Van Dyke, for being on the program. And you are listening to KKCR Hanalei, KAQA, Kilauea. Coming up next, Dee's Diner.